You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, it's particularly if you, like me, love the pelagics. Oh, boy. We're going to get hooked up into that today, like I was telling you earlier. But I also wanted to remind you, I think I started telling you a few weeks ago, if you haven't been to the WP Council website for a while, you better do it. It's been revamped. It's been given a big charge of energy. It's user-friendly. It's got some great new stuff on it, some nice, a lot of good pictures, and just a really good layout on what the council is and who they are, and more importantly, what they're doing and where they're going. It's an ecosystem-based fisheries management in the Pacific. That's what our council is, district. But there are a bunch of them. As a matter of fact, there's 8 different regionals. And as far as landmass goes, I mean miles, we are by far the largest of them. We're not in the economic picture as large as some of the others, but we sure count because we cover a lot of geography. And that means that our guest, he is a PhD, Dr. Mark Fitchett, and he's my pelagic go-to guy. As a matter of fact, when we met, it was when he came here to accept this gig, and we discussed with him how many similarities there were between us and where he came from, and it turned out the whole world is that way. Anyway, joining us today, and we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff, particularly what happened in some of the meetings in Samoa, and if we have time a little later on in the program or on next week, talking about what he's going to be going to Rome, for heaven's sakes. Oh, some serious traveling. Mark, good morning. How you doing, man?
Doing pretty good. How you doing?
Good. You know, I kind of miss it when the meetings are in other places, but I know how important it is to get to the far-reaching, you know, ends of the district. This meeting in Samoa must have been for many an eye opener as to how much attention is being paid in Hawaii and on the mainland to what's happening in their part of the world, far, far away.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's true. And then I think what people don't realize is that in Samoa, American Samoa, and Pongo Pongo, you have the largest private employer south of the equator for the U.S., yeah, which is the tuna cannery.
The tuna cannery, yeah.
And American Samoa is strategically located within a mosaic of island countries with their own sovereign waters, and it's essentially smack dab in the middle. Mm-hmm. You have a Western Samoa, Independent Samoa, the Cook Islands. You have Tonga to the south. You have Fiji, which is just two doors down, mm-hmm, which is a powerhouse as far as fisheries in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. And so the big species of interest down there is albacore. And our fisheries down in American Samoa have been struggling lately. Their catch rates have gone down by about 70%, mm-hmm, and then on top of that,
that's a lot.
A lot. Right,
yeah.
And the fleet has diminished, has gone from over 40 plus boats down to 11 active this year, 13 yeah, last year, 17 the year before. So this trend is a little bit alarming. So the council, and I've kind of taken the reins on putting together some actions to the commission, as well as some research too that I'm trying to get going. But the big thing that we're pushing for is on the international level, getting the United States to see that this is a global United States bigger picture problem, mm-hmm, than just fisheries, because the America Samoa is the conduit for the American economy in the South Pacific.
And you know what I think is very interesting about that is that as much as we think it's the center of our world, which it kind of is, we need to get along with a lot of other countries in that part of the ocean. I mean, it's not all just U.S. There's a lot of players there.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things is as a lot of our interest in fisheries is so continental U.S. centric.
Yeah.
We have a little bit Hawaii, Alaska, but America Samoa is an incredibly important archipelago for the United States as a whole, and it's one of our territories. And like I said, fisheries is the economic footprint. And then what folks a lot also don't realize is to the north of America Samoa, you have the Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia and Palau, which used to be U.S. U.S. ancillary territories that are now independent,
sure,
but they're part of what's called the Compact of Free Associated States. Mm-hmm. So which they use the United States dollar, so United States dollar is in use. But on top of that, there's some agreements that folks can travel from Micronesia to Marshall Islands, United States.
Yeah, and by the way, what Mark's talking about here, yeah, in some of our other shows, we talk about the COFA migrants. These are the people we're talking about.
And, right.
But here's something interesting. From what I understand, when you talk about albacore, when they're doing the tumbos, what they're canning, you know, but it's interesting because they also do, I guess, some skipjack. But whatever happened, wasn't there a big Wahoo or Ono cannery going for a while that is no longer doing it?
They still can Ono down there. Mm-hmm. They still have Wahoo. There is a substantial amount of Wahoo that's caught. Yeah. Down there in American Samoa, actually, I've had Wahoo sandwiches.
I love it.
From canned tuna. They made
Wait. I got to tell you, though. A lot of people in the U.S. really love the Wahoo, but they don't like it being canned in oil.
Yeah.
You know, and to this day, I've never seen Wahoo canned in water. I just don't see it.
Yeah, I think it's also it's a preservation issue.
Mm-hmm.
But the Wahoo, a lot of folks think, a lot of the, you know, Americans look at canned fish and they're like, oh, it's such a waste of such a good product because it's
that's a good point.
Honestly,
they're steaks, really.
Yeah, the Wahoo is pretty good. I've had it, and I've had it almost like a crab cake one time. Mm, it was canned, then they fried it in something. But going back to American Samoa, one of the issues is the albacore catch rates have gone down. And there's concerns. There's two concerns. There's concerns also with the American purseine fleet, which is hamstrung by the number of days that it can fish in the high seas, and then the number of days that they can fish within the U.S. territorial waters and EZs.
Yeah, of course.
So then they're limited. So then the United States purseine fleet then has to pay exorbitant vessel days, which sometimes they pay more than other countries.
And they're paying that to who?
To other countries to fish within their within their sovereign waters. And so you have these restrictions that are putting a hardship on the purseine fishery, and I wouldn't say hardship, but very little incentive to fish around American Samoa and provide skipjack and product and to offload into Pongo Pongo.
Yeah, which is a big hurt for the Samoan population because they rely on that fish.
Right, they rely on the economy. It's an economic driver. You know, they've already lost one cannery, and now they have Starkist there. So that's one issue. And then, as I mentioned with the albacore, the catch rates have gone down. And a lot of the purse seiners in Pongo are providing product to the cannery for canned albacore. There's some fishery issues there. But
are we looking, Mark, excuse me, at overfishing or under catching?
Well, I was going to get to that. So the issue with albacore, it's a really peculiar one. That the stock was assessed in 2017, and so and it was found to not be overfished or be overfishing. So folks, a lot of people in their minds are like, well, then what's the problem?
What's
the stock
problem?
Is healthy. But the reality is that stock trajectory has been going down. It has not. We haven't seen any peaks of it coming back up. It's been a one-way trip in the last three decades.
What could be some of the reasons?
Increased fleet capacity, and so what's happening now is you've seen an explosion in the Chinese longline fleet, which has been fishing albacore both in the North and South Pacific. They've increased their fleet from I think it was in 2008. They had about a dozen distant water longliners.
And they're larger, aren't they?
They have distant water longliners. And then now their nearshore and distant water fleet now is 525 longliners. To put things in perspective,
are they freezing that fish mostly?
A lot of it is, and they actually transship a lot of that too. So they transship a lot of that albacore. You know, it was worth saying the United States does zero transshipment of any of its longline products for any of its fleets. But to put things in perspective, American Samoa in 2018 had 40 boats. Now they're down to 11. In 2008, China had probably about 11, 12 boats. Now they have 525.
Gee whiz.
And so that is an issue.
So one would think, all right, if all of those are gone, that means that they're not catching what they used to catch. That must mean that there's either opportunity or a necessity for smaller boats to catch a lot more fish.
Yeah,
is that even part of the quotient or part of what's going on there? Is the quantity being made up by, you know, smaller boats, smaller trips?
And well, one of the issues, though, I think the underlying issue is that you have, even that the stock is healthy, that product that could be, these fish migrate, right? So they spawn in November north in the Coral Sea, and they move their way down towards Samoa, down into the waters of Tonga, all the way down to Tonga, New Zealand. So what we're seeing, you know, is possibly that this gauntlet of fishing effort in the Solomons and some of these other island areas from China and chartered Chinese boats, and also it's worth mentioning Taiwan, that availability of fish coming through a Samoa has been essentially halted. And that maybe that it's an availability issue, even though the stock is seemingly healthy, that it's an availability issue to these fleets in American Samoa. And so
that's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, a lot of moving parts here. And one thing at the commission meeting last year that was held here in Honolulu, and it was a little bit disappointing, to say the least, that there wasn't enough push behind you know, the United States and French Polynesia, because they also have the same issue too in their fisheries in New Zealand, that they wanted to put what's called a target reference point for the South Pacific albacore
stock.
Yeah,
explain that. Explain
so a target reference point, and for the listeners to understand, is it is a goal for what you want the fishery to be achieving, all right? So it's different from a limit reference point, which is like an absolute value that you do not want the stock to get below a certain level of biomass. A target reference point can be a catch rate. So you want to manage the fishery, perhaps harvest, develop a harvest strategy so that the stock can achieve a certain catch rate for certain fisheries or increase its biomass level. For example, for skipjack, 50% of unfished biomass is the target for skipjack tuna.
Okay.
So usually it waffles up above that, which is sort of a shows that the stock is being successfully managed. With albacore, they didn't have a target; they had a limit.
That limit, I was going to say.
And yeah, so even though we're way above that limit, so the stock was at 52% of unfished biomass, which sounds great. You know, that's a healthy stock, but the fisheries and a lot of these island countries like the Cooks, New Zealand, and American Samoa and Western Samoa wanted to have a target of catch rates for these islands. Because,
oh, boy. Okay.
And so when we went in the room, some of the Asian distant water fishery fleets were no dice, said no dice. We will – and eventually they agreed upon increasing biomass by 4% of his unfished biomass levels, which
is that enough?
Absolutely not.
Doesn't sound like a good faith effort.
And that just puts the onus. What happens is it puts the onus and responsibility of catch controls on these island countries as much as these large Asian distant water fleets, and that's unfair because what's happening is you're having a growing these growing fleets without any type of control on fishing capacity, and then you have these island countries which have been steadily and domestically managed that haven't been increasing the number of longliners and fisheries. And it's not, it's so one of the things that we're trying to push this year at the commission meeting is to, in addition to this interim target reference point that was developed last year and the commission meeting in Hawaii, when we go to Papua New Guinea in December meeting, we want a catch rate to be used as a target.
Yeah, gang, you know, a lot of this, some of it is parsed out on the website, wpcouncil.org. But I think you got to see sort of what the big picture is, because it seems like, and some people here, Mark, have a real tough time. And by the way, Mark is Dr. Mark Fitchett. He's a PhD, and he is the absolute know-all when it comes to the pelagics at the council. That's the seat that he's been filling. We've learned a lot from him in the few months that we've had him on. But I think that a lot of people don't understand that there are some boats in those foreign fleets that would be the same size and shape and sort of conditions our longliners, but they don't have to go to port. I mean, they're getting serviced out there. I mean, they can get new engines, they can get anything. They don't have to go to land, period.
Yeah, and that's true. To an extent, there's what's called transshipment. So you have a carrier vessel that they'll meet up with and they'll offer a product at sea.
Now, the vessel you're talking about is the ship.
Yeah,
it's a big one.
It's a big boat, and they transship. There's rules on where you can transship. You have to transship near a port or in certain areas, like Majuro and Marshall Islands is a transshipping area. There are fisheries that transship in Guam. They're allowed to transship in Guam, not American ships. And within the Federated States of Micronesia, you see a lot of that. And so, you know, and that keeps the vessel efficiency of some of these longliners to be much higher. And what a lot of folks don't understand is that longliners that operate out of American Samoa, they fish and then they offload in Pongo.
Yeah.
Our boats here in Hawaii, we've got 145 active right now. Mm. They fish out of Honolulu Harbor, mm. and they come back and they offload in Honolulu Harbor.
Honolulu Harbor,
you
right.
get a couple that may go to Hilo, but mm. you get almost all
in, back coming back,
back
to Hawaii.
Here yeah. To Pier 38. Yeah. And so, you know, it's the playing field is not level on the international level. And plus, it's worth mentioning for the listeners to understand is that our fleets in American Samoa, they have 20% plus up to 30% observer coverage.
Mm-hmm. By the way, gang, don't be confused, because when we're talking about the shallow set, it's 100%. The one that the fishery that just got shut down, the Shutomi of the swordfish fishery, because yeah. of interactions with turtles, that has 100% observation. So what's coming out of there is 100% science.
Right. And so when we look at these observer, when you look at the percentage of observer coverages, and when you have a number of observers on board and you have electronic monitoring and reporting mm-hmm. that we're developing here in our fisheries in both Pongo and then out of Honolulu, people don't realize is that we are providing best available science for mm-hmm. not only assessing the stocks, but also looking at compliance. And that's a main thing that United States is a leader in. And that includes our fleet in American Samoa.
Yeah. And I must tell you, I've observed this, and this may be good for you to know, in our audience, and particularly in our audience where our commercial people, that they're not just all taking rape. I mean, they respect the science, and they know in order for it to work, everybody has to, you know, either curtail their greed or realize that there are seasons and sizes and things that you have to pay attention with. But they didn't used to trust the science. Now, because of the way that you're presenting all of this stuff, more and more of our listeners are saying, okay, I'm buying in. I'll report. I'll agree. I'll contribute. I'll help.
Yeah, and we actually have, and it's amazing. You talk to the guys at Pier 38 at the auction. You talk to the vessel owners here, mm-hmm. HLA, Hawaii Longline Association, which is now the executive director is Eric Kingma. He used to work at the council.
I teased him, by the way.
Stand up person.
In order to do that, you have to be really tall. Because, you know, when you go to look at Sean and Jimmy Cook and Eric, and these guys are all giants of men. But Eric...
I'm not short either.
Yeah, you know, no, I know. But what I think is really interesting about this is that Eric was a good choice for the HLA because he really gets it because of the international work that he's done. I mean, this guy, he knows all... He would be like, in some respects to me, your kind of counterpart here.
Yeah.
You know, just because of the knowledge base that both of you have.
Well, a lot of what I've learned about the policy and all these things are things that in the short time I've been here working for council is from Eric.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Eric's got the highest level of ethics and character of anybody I know. And so that is just proof right there that the leadership in our fisheries, at least on the industry side, is not as reticent to listen to scientists as they were, say, decades ago.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
And that means for you listeners and gang that the fish that come off these boats, not only are they highly, highly supervised and observed, but it's our first fishery, and maybe you can explain this a little bit. When you talk about Pongo and Guam and all of these other places, their auctions or their sales of fish are not as much for sashimi grade eating as just for food. I don't mean just for food, but you know what I'm getting at? Is
yeah.
that our fishing fleet here operates at a different standard than other fleets.
It does. And that also includes our fleets, though, and it's worth mentioning.
In that part of the world.
But our territories, United States territories, the Marianas, Guam, and Samoa, American Samoa, they also operate at levels of standards for data reporting and compliance that blows the international community out of the water. And that's where, you know, one of the things that we're trying to really push for, or at least the council has been pushing really hard for the United States to put a little bit of teeth behind when we ask for our international counterparts to increase their observer coverages, to reduce transshipment, to incentivize higher observer coverages. Mm-hmm. So when it comes down to getting allocation of quota, you know, those players in the room who've been playing by the rules and exceeding the rules should be able to be rewarded for their actions, and those that are breaking the rules are punished.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And that is not just the credibility of the observers, but what they have to do to, in order to get that job. I mean, obviously, what they observe on is value. There's a lot of value to it because it'll stop a fishery. You know, when you get to, for instance, in the short set, in the shallow set that we just went through, this interaction, not death, but just getting involved with, you know, 17 turtles, boom, it stops.
Yeah. And that says a lot. And the fleet did act very swiftly in stopping the fishing. And the fleet's also been very active in reducing interactions. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a little bit of both sides here. Mm-hmm. And I think some of these rules do motivate the industry to participate in the reduction of bycatch issues. Eric has been behind that big time with HLA. Yeah. And so, you know, that builds opportunities for collaboration between, you know, environmental groups, scientists, and the industry. But the observer, going back to the observer coverage issue, that is so paramount because that helps in not only validating data reporting. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. Observer coverage is great for monitoring, and it's great. It has served its purpose for saying, well, we have real-time data stream of interactions between certain species, and just like with the electronic reporting that we're putting in the fleet. But the big thing that observer coverage does is it validates and verifies catch rate reporting and catch reporting.
Yeah, and you know what? There's another thing, gang, that I hope Mark can explain, because when you say observer, this is not a guy that has a notepad and he's going for a boat ride. These guys, especially today, in the manner in which they transfer the information, it's instantaneous almost. You know, and it's because of technology and other things. Typically, maybe we should stop for just a minute, because it dawned on me before you said what you said a minute ago, is I haven't stopped to really explain to the audience for a long time exactly what these observers are doing.
Yeah, so it varies from region to region, but we have observers in fisheries all over the United States. Mm-hmm. A lot of our pelagic fisheries from the Gulf of Mexico. We have observers on boats out of Dutch Harbor all the way up there in Alaska. Mm-hmm. We have observers everywhere.
Yeah.
And here in Hawaii...
Where do most of them come from? Most of them are young kids, young folks.
And you get a lot of adventure-minded folks, but a lot of them, they're all educated, college-educated, and they're knowledgeable in fisheries.
Most of them heading for a career or something in fisheries.
And so, and they're put on boats here. They have put boats on in Hawaii on longliners. There are observers that are put on purse seine boats out of Pongo, as well as some of the longliners in Pongo Pongo. The observers also work with the commission, the WCPFC. Mm-hmm. So we report data back to NOAA, and then they also report back data back to the WCPFC, or which is the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission.
How valuable is that? That's really valuable.
It's very valuable. And the other countries have their own observer programs too. The Pacific Islands community has their own observer program, and they work and contribute to the total regional observer.
I'm so glad. And that's just, by the way, we could talk whole segments on these observers. But I think there's another important thing, and people always ask me, okay, when we hear these programs, it sounds great that the reporting's being done, the closures, the openings, and everything else. But what about enforcement? And what about the other guys? I mean, we know about our boats having all these observers, but it must be very frustrating for some of them to be transversing, coming back or going to wherever they're going, and being in areas where people are not doing the best practices that our guys are mandated to do.
Well, and that's kind of goes back to my original point. You know, we're talking about the albacore, and when we're talking about fighting over getting quota for big eye tuna here in Hawaii, one of the issues is there isn't a level playing field, and there doesn't seem to be much, as I like to put, teeth behind some of these compliance measures. Now, in enforcement, at least in the Western and Central Pacific, is the United States. The United States Coast Guard works extremely hard. People don't understand the amount of patrolling they do.
I mean, unbelievable.
Anything. Yeah. It's not just for fisheries. It's for
drugs.
Human trafficking.
It's human. It's everything. Yeah.
You know, and for national security, the footprint that they have. France, through French Polynesia, they're big. They've been very aggressive lately. I've been hearing reports boarding Chinese boats off of their off of French Polynesia in the Central Pacific, Central South Pacific, and then another huge key player that is a partner and ally of the United States in enforcement is New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Kiwis have Wallace and Fortuna nearby, and they also patrol and they assist in emergencies out of Western Samoa and American Samoa.
Yeah, and after the last couple of times I've been down there, their presence is obvious. And that's another thing. These are our partners, and they've been our partners forever. Australia, New Zealand.
Australia, yeah.
I mean, it really is gratifying. But I think more importantly than that, it really gets people to understand that if you don't say something, nothing's going to happen. I do know that here, inshore, they can call 6293 or 624 DLNR and report things and all that stuff. But there also is a system whereby I think that I'm starting to, and I hope my audience is, and gang, when you're talking with Dr. Mark Fitchett, our guest today, you're talking about all of this information that is now presented in much more concise form. I want to go back just a minute, if you don't mind, to the meetings that just held in Samoa, because I do know that a lot of the fruits of all of your all labors for the last year were put on the table down there for people to make some pretty important decisions on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of those were these recommendations on to the commission. So we had a couple ones going back to what we're discussing about the fishery issue in Samoa.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the recommendations that were made, at least in the interest of pelagics, was really putting a push for the United States delegation to come up with an allocation catch scheme for a South Pacific albacore.
Mm-hmm.
And what this means is get the commission and propose something that would create catch levels by country. And right now for South Pacific albacore, there really isn't a catch allocation scheme like there is for big eye tuna, scheme.
You know, I know that you learned this really quickly when you got here. When you start talking about albacore here, or tumbo as most of us call it, we're not as fired up about it. You know, it's not the tuna of choice because of the oil and the consistency and other things. But talk about how on the mainland, the albacore is the preferred tuna because it is not as greasy or as fatty as the ahi.
I mean, I'd say that's for people who don't know tuna. And I say that in jest.
For the others, I know.
Because, you know, you ain't going to beat an aku bowl or ahi bowl, when it comes to fresh
bowl,
fish.
Just not the same.
Not at all. Yeah. And they love it in Russia. They love it in Canada, too. But, you know, I mean, albacore, and that's good that you bring that up, because there is this big eye, yellowfin, bluefin, eccentric type of or viewpoint on tuna, that they just want to look at these tuna species. And we got one of the reasons why I'm talking about South Pacific albacore is because we have a territory down there in the South Pacific that is an American territory that albacore is the keynote
species.
It's
the key,
We need to be paying more attention. It's something that we need to drive home. We need to look after these folks down there. And also, we have a cannery that needs to provide skipjack tuna to its cannery to maintain to keep its doors open.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because let's spend a minute, if you don't mind, for the skipjack in Hawaii. First of all, the big picture. And next time, Mark's going to be back in next week. We're going to talk about a project, the Tagging the Heavy. We're going to talk about, he's going to be going to Rome, talking about spatial management and in blue water territories and all this really exciting stuff. But I think if you go back to that, if you go back to the argument that I seem to think is being sort of more accepted by most of us, is that we're not waiting for the Japan current to bring us bluefin, big eye and ahi, that we're starting to pretty well identify our indigenous ahi and big eye stocks. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to some research projects we're working on, looking at genetics.
Yeah.
And delineating stock structure. There is reason to believe that the Hawaiian Islands and our fishery, Hawaii longline fishery, and as well as our Ikashibi troll handline fishery, are catching fish that have, or within two groups, there's probably a natal stock here in our area here in the Hawaiian Islands. And we also get a lot of transient fish that are coming between other regions that are a little bit more. So there's
every now and again, Mark, isn't it kind of neat that some oddball fish shows up? Yeah. And it's not supposed to be in Hawaii. What is this fish doing here?
And folks have put tags on. Yeah. Folks have put tags on ahi that have shown that they beeline it back to the eastern Pacific.
Yeah, amazing.
Which can mean that perhaps, you know, that we are a sort of a mixed bag of transient fish. But there is a distinct genetic population here, which means that they spawn and they come back.
Right here.
In Hawaii. But the thing is different subgroups of fish may behave differently. They're, you know, fish have what's called a niche, right? They fulfill a role in the ecosystem, but they also have an inherent behavior for them to go back, what's called natal phylopatry. They go back to where they're spawned. And so what happens is some groups of fish may be more migrant than others. Yeah. And so that's worth looking into, and we're trying to do some tagging work and genetics work to look at gene flow versus fish flow.
Isn't it sort of interesting when you categorize turtles doing the same thing? Or you go up Pacific Northwest and look at salmon going up the same. In other words, fish, they may be a little bit more communicative and smarter than we think.
Yeah.
You know, they may have a mission. Okay. Unfortunately for time, with Dr. Fritchett, we're going to run out of time.
All right.
This show, but there's so much on our plate, and I already knew that. We're going to get together again next week, not only talk about Big Eye and the Eye and everything else, but also another thing about small boat fisheries, what Mark's found out as a pelagic guy on that. And given the opportunity, some of the other stuff, a tagging project for Heavy, we'll tell you what that's all about. And something called spatial management. And it's going all the way to Roma. Arrivederci, Roma. I can't believe it. He's so lucky. And hey, don't forget, if you want to hear something on the program, drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. We'll see you again next week. Have good luck. Catch a lot of fish. Have a lot of fun. See you next time.